A few weeks ago, I had my annual consultation with the district superintendent. It is something that every time this year, all the pastors in this district have with the district superintendent to just talk about how things are going. And during my last meeting with our good friend J.C. Powell, our district superintendent, he shared with me an experience that he had when he was a sophomore, a college student at the University of South Florida in Tampa. And as was the case with many colleges and universities in the country, they were all required to take certain courses, and one of those requirements was a class in general humanities and philosophy that many of us, I'm sure, have taken at one point or another. And there he was, a sophomore in a huge university, sitting in a class of about 150, in a course where you didn't have the same lecturer week after week. You had a class where the professors would rotate in and out and give a couple guest lecture sessions and then disappear and have another person take the place. JC told me a story about one particular class session where he was sitting there and this brand new professor came and stood up before them to give the morning's lecture. The way you would understand it from JC, he was a sharply dressed professor. He was young and just received his PhD and kind of had a brash smirk on his face as if he was about to impress all these other students who were probably only 5 or so years younger than him. And this young professor, so learned and so refined, stood in front of that huge crowd of students, and his opening sentence to his first lecture was, "No intelligent person can believe in God." And JC told me at that very moment, he said, there was a fury that erupted in him like none that had erupted against any professor. He thought to himself, how dare that professor stand in front of all those students and insult me and other religious folks like me? Because if you really follow this professor's reasoning, if only the intelligent people didn't believe in God, then the converse must be true. If you believe in God, then you must be foolish, right? Does that sound offensive to you? It sounded offensive to JC, but really we've heard statements like this professor's before. It really wasn't too long ago when, as a culture, a theology erupted that proclaimed that God was dead. Rational and empirical thinking had proven that the church and the faith had no business dealing with the truth. Products of the Enlightenment and the scientific age went through long, painstaking efforts to prove that all the things that Christians believe weren't in fact true, and that actually if you had faith, you had no business in the realm of the intelligent. Do you remember Yuri Gagarin? He was the Russian cosmonaut who was the first to go into orbit and fly into space, and he, in so many words, declared that he was in the heavens and there was no God to be found. And so there must not be a God. And so through modern technology, we have slowly taken away the mysteries of life's existence. We take a look at a fellow human being, and instead of seeing in that person the image of God, and seeing the miraculous and the mystical, we instead see clumps of DNA, molecules of carbon, metabolic cycles, and cellular mitosis. We have reduced the human mystery, and indeed the mysteries of God, into formulas and facts and figures. And many have come to that same conclusion as that professor, you know, that intelligent people believe in intelligent things, and foolish people believe in foolish things like God. You might be surprised that as much as things have changed over the past 2,000 years, the more they've stayed the same. Because we read this morning from the very quill, the very hand, the very scroll of the Apostle Paul, those words in 1 Corinthians that he wrote, intelligent people don't believe in God. Only foolish people do. Listen again to his words. For the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For God's foolishness, he says, is wiser than human wisdom, and God's weakness is stronger than human strength. Surprising words. He's saying nothing more than that professor did. And not only that, these are confrontational words, because he too wants to separate the intelligent things from the foolish things. And surprising that it comes in a letter that really is all about reconciliation and joining together and healing division. But it seems clear on this issue that Paul wants to draw a line. He seems to suggest that if you're trying to figure out the mysteries of God with your mental capabilities, you're a dead duck. If you try to figure out the cross and the empty tomb using your mind, you're dead in the water. You can't figure out God with your textbooks and your formulas and the wisdom of the world because your brain won't let you. The human mind is limited in its abilities to understand the depth and the meaning and the mysteries of faith. There was a conversation that took place between an atheist and a Quaker. Now, you can't put together two people that are as far apart on the theological spectrum as an atheist and a Quaker. But they shared this great conversation, this wonderful dialogue. Atheist, did you ever see God? Quaker, no. Atheist, did you ever smell God? Quaker, no. Atheist, well then, how can you be so sure that there is a God? Quaker, friend, hast thou ever seen thy brains? Atheist, no. Quaker, and hast thou ever smelled thy brains? Atheist, no. Quaker, well, friend, dost thou truly believe thou hast brains? Our mental faculties can only carry us so far in understanding God before things get totally confusing. After all, does it really make sense to you that a God who is so huge and so majestic and so powerful can care so personally about so many? Does it really make sense to you that you have to turn the other cheek when others abuse you? Does it really make sense to you that God would come down and live a perfect life so dramatically and preach real truth only to die a sinner's death? Does it really make sense to you that in order to be first, you have to be last? Does it make sense to you that a simple faith can move mountains? Really, all the things that we believe are so counterintuitive. And to the world, they are countercultural. They are foolishness. They are rubbish. But for Christians, it is wisdom. It's really the only words that matter. The only words that really do make sense to us. And so this is the dichotomy that Paul talked about. He was living in a time when there was division in the church about how to use your mind. There were those who were preaching that the one thing that matters is your mental capabilities and your intellect, and if you depend on that, then you can understand God. There were others who were believing that all that really mattered was your inner and private experiences. Some were advocating that salvation really means nothing more than what happens to you at the end of time, at the final judgment. There were others who were saying that salvation is significant for the here and the now. And Paul was stuck in that division, stuck in a tug of war where he was trying to tell the Corinthian church really what really mattered and to try to bring some healing into a situation that was tearing the church apart. And so Paul, in a way that only Paul could, used an incredible image in a very clever way. He said that Jews demanded signs and Greeks demanded wisdom, but we proclaim what? Christ crucified. A stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles, He said, the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us it is the power of God. The cross. That's what Paul uses to heal this division. Why the cross? Because for Paul, in that time, the symbol of the cross for many meant defeat. Many saw the cross as public humiliation, as a failure. Conventional wisdom marked it as the symbol of death, that you lost, that you were being punished, and that you are personally going to be destroyed. But for Paul, the Christian faith was anything but conventional. It was anything by what the world meant. It is a faith where the underdog wins. It is a faith where the oppressive are set free, where those who are captive are liberated. It is a faith that is countercultural, completely subversive, and it flips the world on its ear. So why use the cross? Because it is the perfect symbol of what God has done. God has taken that symbol of defeat and humiliation and failure and turned it into victory. In a way that the world could not understand, the cross is no longer failure for Christians. It is acceptance. It is salvation. It is victory in Jesus Christ. And so it is something that the world cannot understand, left to its own merits. A symbol where God communicates a single message to those who understand and those who do not. The revelation that says that God so loved the world that whosoever believeth in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. I don't know what situation you find yourself in this morning. I don't know if you've been searching for God or for meaning and purpose in your life. Perhaps you've only been using your intellect to guide you through this world. So you need to hear these words again. Not my words, Paul's words, God's words. The message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. Though your efforts have been good, God has given you help in the form of a gift that you can receive not through the merits of your mind, but through the free acceptance of your heart. A gift called grace, a gift called acceptance, forgiveness, and it is free for you to accept. And I don't know this morning if you're feeling like you're kind of on a spiritual plateau, that you haven't really been on many mountaintops as of late. You're dry, you're in need of a kickstart or a boost or whatever words you want to choose. Whatever it is, you may want to hear Paul's words again for your situation as well. I'll read them to you again. The message about the cross is foolishness for those who are perishing. But to those who are being saved, it is the power of God. The power of God. God has taken this symbol of death and destruction, of humiliation and despair, and transformed it and flipped it on its ear and given it new meaning. It means new life. It means victory over death. And it means new purpose, new meaning, and new direction. And if God can do that with such a tragic symbol that means so much, what can God do with you, a faithful and obedient servant? God can transform you because the cross is the power of God. Open your heart and your mind to the transformation that God offers you. There's a final story here that I want to share. It's about a young man named John Sung. Perhaps you've never heard of him. He was born at the turn of this century, and he was the son of a Methodist minister. And he grew up in a Christian family. And so as a youth, he traveled with his father, and at an early age, he became known as the boy preacher with incredible intellect and exceptional talent. He was brilliant. He received scholarships from many colleges and universities across the country and eventually focused all of his energies on his education, receiving numerous degrees in the field of chemistry and physics. 1926, he received a doctorate from Ohio State University. This was a bright man. This was a guy who, in the world's standards, was intelligent. But in his own mind, he was not happy, because he couldn't forget his Christian heritage. And there he was studying his chemistry and his physics, but in the back of his mind was still the Christian teachings that he learned as a child. And so he was a soul on a search for new meaning and purpose in his life. And a friend, a trusted advisor, encouraged those urgings in him and encouraged him to follow the course of ordained ministry. And so he followed that course and enrolled in Union Theological Seminary, one of the most prestigious seminaries in the entire world. But instead of clarity in his beliefs, he got more confused. His mind became murkier. And he didn't know which religious perspective that was thrown at him to believe anymore. In his own words, he said, "My soul wandered in a wilderness. I could neither sleep nor eat. My faith was like a leaking, storm-driven ship without a captain or a compass. My heart was filled with the deepest unhappiness." But then his life changed in a most peculiar way. Some friends invited him to go to a local gathering where they were going to have a guest speaker come and talk about matters of faith. He was a famous preacher, a fellow PhD, just like John. And so excitedly, he accepted the invitation to go hear this preacher. After all, who else to explain to him the things that he was confused about than a fellow PhD? Someone else from the academia, someone who could talk to him on his own terms. And so he showed up at this meeting house disappointed, because he found out that this famous PhD lecturer could not make it. And instead, they were going to have, as their speaker, a 15-year-old girl. And how disappointed John was. How could a PhD like himself possibly learn anything from a 15-year-old girl who hadn't even gotten her high school diploma? But as soon as she started speaking, it was too late for John to leave, so he decided to stay that first night. And friends, there was something about this 15-year-old girl who was not brilliant by any doctoral standards, but spoke in a penetrating way, in a moving way, about the God who loved her and the Jesus Christ who saves her. And so John was so moved by this 15-year-old girl that he stayed that entire time and didn't leave, and then came back the next night to hear her speak again to that same gathering. And then he came back the next night and went back the next night. 5 nights in a row, John came back to hear this 15-year-old girl preach a simple message. We don't know who this girl was, but she preached a message that made the wise look foolish and the foolish look wise. A simple message about a loving God and a saving Christ, no more and no less. So John rededicated his life to God and to God's service. After he received his PhD in chemistry and physics, he received numerous opportunities to teach in the most prestigious colleges and universities in the entire world. But John turned them all down. He read his Bible as aggressively as he did his academic books. He incorporated a devotional life into his academic life so that both became balanced and both were strong. And he began to sing and he began to preach so loudly that the folks at the seminary thought he was insane. Literally, at one point, the seminary officials had him committed to a mental health institution because of the outwardness of his faith. But he wasn't insane. They thought he was foolish, but he wasn't. He was made wise through Jesus Christ. And so after he left seminary, he turned down all of those teaching positions to start missionary work in a distant place called the People's Republic of China. And today, if you were to look in a book of famous 20th century missionaries, you very likely will find his name, John Sung, because he became one of the most famous evangelists in China. Hear this again, one more time. A message that sounds so simple that it sounds so foolish, but it will change your life. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. In the name of the Creator, the Redeemer, and the Sustainer of us all. Amen.